Episode 66. This one, we talk about Mario. Mario Lemieux is one of the greatest athletes of all time. In the 1988-89 season, he was truly dominant. 199 points in just 76 games, including 31 power play goals and 13 shorthanded goals. Now, Daniel Kahneman, based on Thinking Fast and Slow, would say that a little bit of luck was required for this. And if you go back into the stats, he's right. Mario Lemieux had a shooting percentage that year of 27%, the highest of his career. But this doesn't take away from the fact that throughout his career, Mario Lemieux averaged 0.71 goals per game in the playoffs, the highest of all time. Nobody even comes close. Truly magnificent. Beyond MD, episode 66, here we go! Guys, thank you so much for joining me on another episode of Beyond MD. I'm really excited to have you here as I dive into another one of my solo episodes. Today, we're going to be talking about some of the challenges that I've had with investing in the markets, being a DIY investor. Now, don't get me wrong, a lot of good things have happened, but I've made some mistakes as well. And there have been some mental hurdles that I've had to overcome. And I think that what I experience applies to a lot of other retail investors out there. So I hope you find the content here helpful. Before we dive into the content itself, I have a few housekeeping issues. So episode 65, the last episode was on the AMT, alternative minimum tax changes, and a few people provided some feedback. I do want to acknowledge Patrick Bowman on Facebook, who pointed out that in one of the examples that we gave in that episode, it made it sound like any level of charitable gifting is going to result in more tax owing. And I just want to clear it up that that conception there is false. So the example that we talked about was a somewhat extreme example, but an individual having $500,000 of capital gains, as well as a $300,000 charitable donation. Now, these are big numbers, but the example was delivered in this way, I think, to illustrate some of the real changes that are happening with the new AMT rules, especially as it pertains to charitable gifting. And I think that the AMT owing in that example was quite high, $49,000, give or take. And I think it made it seem like the charitable donation was the chief cause, like the main cause of that AMT owing. But I just want to reiterate that charitable gifting is still a good thing. Charitable gifting is not a bad thing. And even in that example, charitable gifting alone is not going to be the sole driver of AMT because the investor also has a sizable capital gain. But what I want people to understand is changes are being put in place such that charitable gifting, while still a good thing, it's not as tax efficient as it used to be, especially when you're talking about large amounts, when combined with capital gains and carrying forward capital losses, such that the taxable income under the new AMT calculations is well over that exemption of $173,000. So if I confused anybody, I really apologize, and I can see why that example could be misconstrued. So hopefully that does clear things up. Okay, next up, I'd like to thank a few people. Brenda Farnquist, who is the president of the BC Radiological Society based out of Kelowna General Hospital, and Sylvia Chang, who is the vice chair of professionalism and wellness at the Department of Radiology based out of Vancouver General Hospital. Both are radiologists and both invited me as a visiting professor to the University of British Columbia to talk to the Department of Radiology about personal finance. And guys, I have to say that this is the stuff that I truly love doing. So Brenda, Sylvia, thank you so much for the opportunity and the invitation. The first session, I sat down with the residents of the program of radiology, and they asked just amazing questions. So we had a 3-hour session talking about common sense investing, registered accounts, home ownership and real estate, and also a little bit on incorporation. And then I was able to give a talk during grand rounds on a basic finance, but how to get the odds on your side. And hopefully it was well received. I really enjoyed giving it. And I just want to say that this is the second time I've done a talk like this for universities. I went to Queen's University last year, which was incredible as well. Both of these schools happen to be my alma mater. But I find that there really is an opportunity here to sneak information like this into the curriculum. I think that a little bit later is better as long as it's not interfering with exams. But I think that if we can get the information to trainees as they're about to enter the real world, it becomes much more impactful. So for any other programs out there looking for content or looking for ways to inject this material into the curriculum, please feel free to reach out to me, LinkedIn or beyondmdpodcast@gmail.com. All right, let's get on to the meat of the episode now, which is what I've learned about investing over the years, some of the mistakes that I've made. And I think that all of you are going to learn something from this. At least I hope you do. So number one, placing way too much emphasis on the price of a stock. And let me back up for a second before I get into part one. Let me just talk about what I tend to do. So as most of you know, I think by now, I tend to invest in the United States and the rest of the world through a single ETF holding called XAW by BlackRock. That just gives me a one-stop shop for ex-Canada. And then because I'm a little bit of a nut and I like to learn about what makes a good business, how do businesses work, I do like to buy individual Canadian securities, especially through my corporate investing account. Now, I do spend about 1 to 2 hours a week reading up on companies, learning about companies, and then when earnings season comes around, I do my best to try and take the time to actually tune into the earnings call to see how things are going. And there are a lot of metrics that I track. Why do I do this? To many people, it's a complete waste of time. For me, I love numbers and I simply love to learn about the world and I love to learn about businesses. And I take full responsibility for some potentially painful lessons that I could learn down the road. This is how I invest my own money. I do not invest my kids' money in their RESP this way. I tend to use ETFs for that. Now, the last year, I think everybody did really well. I certainly was overjoyed with my performance through my corporate investing account. It returned 31%. This is the highest return that I have had year to date. But again, it's 1 year. It really means nothing. So mistake number one, placing way too much emphasis on the price of a stock. Let me take you back to a story in 2019. A lot of people were talking about Walt Disney. And then it came to my mind as well. It's an iconic brand and I wanted to get involved. And there was a lot of talk about how Disney would be the company that would absolutely dominate the streaming wars. So I was out in the garden one day watering the lawn and I was listening to an analyst on CNBC talk about Disney. All of a sudden, the price had dropped to $132 a share. And this analyst deemed that this was the buying opportunity for Disney. Well, it turned out that this was the opportunity that I was waiting for because I dropped the hose, left the water on, ran upstairs, logged into my RBC direct investing account, and just started buying shares of Disney. What is the problem with this scenario? There's too many, but let's go through as many as we can. Number one, I did not really have a well thought out investment thesis on Disney. It was a great brand. It was maybe going to do very well in streaming, but that's not really a well-constructed investment thesis on a company. Number two, I did not have a good understanding of Disney's business model. Yes, it's got parks. Yes, it's got merchandise. Yes, it's going into streaming, but you know, what proportion of Disney's revenue comes from all of these segments? How are these segments trending? I lacked that knowledge. Problem number three is that I really lacked an understanding of the key metrics. So if you're going to invest into individual securities, you don't just look at the price, you don't just jump into a company, you really have to study it. So I did not understand how Disney's revenue was trending. I didn't have an understanding of their earnings per share, their dividend growth. So they used to have a dividend, then they cut their dividend, then they've reinstated the dividend. I lacked an understanding on the return on capital invested or the return on capital employed. I did not have an understanding of Disney's debt situation, nor did I understand what their cash flow was like. So I really lacked understanding of this company from a macro and micro perspective before jumping in. The next issue with how I acted in this situation was I was basically putting price at the forefront. And I also had no idea about Disney's valuation, so its price to earnings ratio compared to its historical norms. This is something that I always like to look into before diving into the company. It's just in my nature, how I was raised. I like to find deals. So I will tend to pick up things when it's trading at a lower price to earnings ratio than its historical average. And then there was a big time recency bias here. A lot of people were talking about Disney. This analyst on CNBC was talking about Disney. This was the last thing I heard and I acted on it. I always encourage people to get multiple perspectives before making an investment, especially if you're investing in individual securities. And also, it can be very useful to write down your investment thesis after getting these multiple perspectives. And it can be very useful to talk to other investors. I'll give a shout out to my buddy, Khalil Jivraj. At the time, we kind of placed our bets. I picked Disney over Netflix. He picked Netflix over Disney. And he couldn't be more right. But the point here is, talk to other people, get multiple perspectives, and please do not place too much emphasis on price alone. So how did Disney work out for me? Well, since my initial investment and repurchases over time, I'm down about 2 to 3%. Not going to make me, not going to break me, but lessons to be learned. Okay, investing pitfall number two is not fully understanding what you are investing in. Now, this is a bit of an extension from pitfall number one, where I talked about price. But there are some differences here. So I'm going to use an investment that I made as an example, CVS. CVS, I started investing in this in 2019 after I was watching Mad Money with Kramer, a show that I no longer watch. I know many of you will be happy to hear that. But I will say one thing that Kramer is really good at is that given how long he's been involved in this space, he does from time to time have a really good understanding of certain companies and their management and are they being managed by the right people. I think that's where the strength of his show is. But anyways, it's irrelevant now. I don't watch it anymore because I just don't think it gives me the information I need to make my investment decisions. But I bought it in 2019 because the stock price was around $60 and Kramer said like this is going to 80 plus and it did. Like in the pandemic days, it went over $100. And then I talked to one of my buddies in Ohio who I did fellowship with, Aditya Bahel, who is a very savvy investor, really smart guy. And he mentioned to me on a phone call, he said, Yatin, CVS is a great business. And guys, I like took those words and I ran to RBC Direct Investing, bought some more shares. Totally nuts, right? I thought that CVS essentially was the Shoppers Drug Mart of Canada. Like I use Shoppers all the time. Why the heck would I not invest in CVS? But then recently, after it came out with actually a very decent earnings report, I recently studied the company again more closely to better understand its business model. So it does get some income from its store products. It gets income from its pharmacies. And it's investing heavily into clinics. So minute clinics, which are going to generate some revenue. But then I dug a little bit deeper and I saw that its return on invested capital was between 5 and 10%. Not bad, but not as high as I would like. I would like to see something in the double digits to make it a true core holding that I can continue to buy. CVS in the healthcare space is also going to be facing some competition, right? Amazon with One Medical. I believe Walmart's also getting into this space. So there's going to be tons of competition out there. And then CVS is a fixture in the United States, but what are the avenues for true organic growth? I didn't really see it. So at the end of the day, I decided not to make it a core holding. But the point here is that I felt much more comfortable with that decision of not buying more shares of CVS because I took the time to actually understand the company. And for anyone who's interested, I'm only up 11.5% on CVS. That excludes the dividend. If you add the dividend of between 3 to 3.5% a year, you're getting up to maybe 6% a year. So not amazing, not terrible, but I'm certainly not buying more into this company to make it a core holding based on what I know today. All right, so under the same theme of investing only in what you know, I want to talk now about a situation where I invested in a company, and I think the result was a little bit better. We all have investors that we like to learn from. One of the investors I like to learn from is Peter Lynch, who ran the Magellan Fund. He, in his videos, would always talk about the importance of investing only in what you understand. He would even say that some investors have an edge, and you should use that edge and knowledge when you are investing. I think that's really, really logical. So we are healthcare professionals, a lot of us anyways, and in front of us, we have an aging patient population that we are looking after. And we know that over time, the population will continue to age. And we know that there is a limited supply of retirement residences and long-term care facilities. This brings me to the company I'm about to discuss, which is Sienna Senior Living. The ticker is SIA.TO. Please don't rush out and buy any shares. Again, this is only for education. Hear me out here. So I will argue that I may have a slightly greater edge than the average person in understanding a company like Sienna. The only reason for this is that my dad, who is a retired family doctor, he started a retirement home about 10 years ago. He bought the land, filled it up with staff and residents, and he managed it for many years. And then he sold it in March 2022. But over the years, it was a crazy, crazy ride for him. But we had many conversations on the business, and I started to learn from him by asking him questions. I started to learn about the business model, what it took to run a place like this, what the headwinds were, what the tailwinds were. And that knowledge through those conversations made me feel a lot more comfortable when exploring a company like Sienna Senior Living for investment. So Sienna Senior Living is a senior living provider in Ontario, BC, and Saskatchewan, and they run 93 residences as of today. So in January 2023, Sienna Senior Living actually bought a facility in Barrie called Woods Park. This was about 175 beds total for $26 million. My sense from talking to my dad is that this is a pretty good price, and I was able to get his validation on something like this. And if somebody is investing in a company and you see a company like Sienna picking up good assets at a good price when the real estate sector is correcting, for the long term, that's usually a pretty good thing. Now, my investment thesis for Sienna is that I think the demand for their facilities continues to go up over time because of our aging population. I think that the supply of these facilities remains somewhat limited, at least for the foreseeable future. And then I want to understand their metrics. Their net operating income across sectors is growing at around 10 to 15% a year right now. And then I study very closely the funds from operation, the FFO, and the adjusted funds from operation, the AFFO. These are important metrics for Sienna and real estate companies and trusts, not the price to earnings ratio. So the AFFO right now is also increasing at around 10% a year, which is pretty good. Their occupancy is increasing. Now, one thing I'm really careful about tracking is what percentage of their AFFO, their adjusted funds from operation per share, what percentage of that goes towards maintaining their dividend? Because this company, Sienna, pays a hefty dividend. It's averaged around 8% for the last 2 years. And guys, you have to be really careful anytime you invest in a company that pays a dividend of more than 5%, because sometimes those dividends are not sustainable. And what we know is that companies that cut their dividends, if you invest in these companies, you will tend to underperform the market. That's something I want to avoid at all costs. So I keep very close tabs on what percentage of that AFFO per share is going towards maintaining the dividend. What scared me in 2022 is that 99% of the AFFO went towards maintaining the dividend. I do not like to see that. The good news is that that percentage dropped to 91% in 2023. I'm keeping a close eye on it because in the last quarter, it went up to 96%. So bottom line, this is a company that I feel like I understand a little bit better. I have learned about over time, but it's a company that I follow very, very closely quarter to quarter. And their financial statements are, I think, laid out really, really well. So how has this investment performed? The share price since I bought it 4 years ago and over additional repurchases, it's only gone up on average about 12% over 4 years. So that's 3% a year. But remember, they pay a hefty dividend of 8%. So annualized returns of about 11% per year. I fully realize that the dividend is going to be taxable, not as tax efficient as just capital gains. But overall, it's been a sound investment, one that I will continue to hold, but one that I will really follow very closely. But remember, guys, never hold an investment because I hold it or somebody else holds it. You invest in something because you believe in it, and most importantly, because you fully understand it. There is never an exception to that rule. Okay, lesson number three. Sometimes it pays to not take drastic action. Let me illustrate this through a story. So in 2019, I decided to invest in NVIDIA. This was not an informed decision. I knew that the company was involved in gaming, and again, I'd been hearing a lot about it, so I bought some shares. After I bought the shares, the company fell about 20 to 30%. I was so distraught, I almost sold all my shares. Usually I'm someone who doesn't act too quickly. I take time to make decisions, as some of my friends know. So I ended up holding on to my NVIDIA shares. And as time went on, I bought a few more. Obviously, the company ended up doing really, really well. End of May 2023, I was sitting on maybe around 600% gains. I decided also in 2023, I wanted to become charitable. I had talked to my wife, Seema, about this. I had seen the positive impact that sport and recreation had had on our two boys, especially our older son, Rohan. He developed so much confidence playing hockey, playing soccer, and I wanted to make sure that other youth in Canada would have the same opportunities. So my driving factor here was to become charitable. And so what I thought would be worthwhile would be transferring some of my appreciated NVIDIA shares to charity. And as we've kind of discussed on the podcast, this can be a tax-efficient way to give to charity. So the capital gains on your corporate investment, let's say you invest at price A, you donate at price B. The difference between B and A is your capital gain. That capital gain ends up being tax-free when you transfer these shares directly to a registered charity. You end up getting a charitable receipt in the amount of the entire donation. I use that to basically negate the majority of my corporate taxes for 2023, which was also nice. And then basically, if you have the funds available in your corporation, you can move the equivalent of that capital gain tax-free from the corporation to your personal hands through the capital dividend account. I was also able to do that and ended up putting some of that money to work in my RRSP, generating another personal tax deduction. So there are a lot of tax efficiencies at work here. And that was in the back of my mind, a second driver here. Now, guys, what I ended up doing in this case was I ended up donating 80% of the appreciated NVIDIA shares that I held to charity. And I held on to 20%. Yes, that is drastic action. But remember, my main motivating factor here was to become charitable. And I'm so happy that I was charitable. This process allowed me to connect with people, expand my network. I was able to connect with an organization. And I even had the chance to make a site visit out to a tennis program to see the impact that donations would be having on today's youth. For me, that was incredibly meaningful. And what my hope is that our family continues to be charitable over the years. I really want this to become a part of our financial fabric. But I'm going to shift gears for a second and evaluate the decisions I made at that time through a different lens. I'm going to look at it from the perspective of somebody who is a long-term investor and somebody who is managing the portfolio, because I think there truly is a lot to learn here. So at that time, I was absorbing a lot of content as well, and I tuned into some interviews. And one interview in particular I listened to on CNBC featuring Josh Brown, and he was at the time unloading about 25% of his stake in NVIDIA. But how he delivered the interview was incredible. There was such a focus on short-term information. And before I paraphrase the interview and get into the details, I just want to reiterate, I think that Josh Brown is a very intelligent individual. He has a great pulse on things, and he's very effective in communicating to his listeners. But what he said in this interview was essentially that this run-up in NVIDIA was one for the ages. It has rarely ever been this overbought. He mentioned that currently, in May 2023, at the time of the interview, that the RSI, the relative strength index of NVIDIA, was 86. The relative strength index is basically a short-term indicator of how overbought or how oversold a stock is. If you're under 30 on the RSI, something is oversold. If you're above 70, you're overbought. Anywhere between the two, you're fairly neutral. NVIDIA was 86 at this time. He mentioned that in 2021, when the stock price peaked initially, the RSI was 89. In 2011, the RSI hit 91, and in the dot-com bubble, the RSI for NVIDIA was 81, not the 86 that it was today, and that its price in May 2023 was 46% above its 50-day moving average. Rarely has NVIDIA been this overbought, and when it is this overbought, the returns over the next 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months tend to be pretty dismal. In fact, they can be as low as 52% in the negatives. Guys, this is unbelievable because most inexperienced investors, myself in this case, if you dial into an interview like this, you are going to be thinking, oh my goodness, if I don't do something with my NVIDIA shares, my returns could be cut in half. I don't want to lose that money. The other thing I really want to reiterate here is that it is imperative. It is absolutely crucial to pay attention to who we are listening to and what time frame they are talking about. Many times when we tune into CNBC, people are talking about the short term. The RSI is a short-term metric. We should focus on remaining long-term investors. The other point I want to make is that it is really, really difficult to know when to sell a stock. And putting aside my charitable donation, if I was just acting on the behalf of my portfolio and managing my portfolio, in the moment, I did not do enough to investigate the fundamentals of NVIDIA. I did not do enough to investigate what the tailwinds would be for that company. This is stuff you really need to understand before you decide whether or not you want to sell. Also, what I've learned is that once you sell out of a position, it can be really difficult to get back into a position. The truth is, after I donated my appreciated NVIDIA shares, the price of NVIDIA traded sideways for almost 6 months. I had ample time to get back in if I wanted to. The truth is, I was waiting for the price to actually fall much lower, closer to around 300 before getting in. I never saw that. And here's my next point. I was so fixated on price over valuation. Inexperienced investors will tend to get fixated on price. What's happened to NVIDIA's price today? It has skyrocketed to about $790. But the unbelievable thing is that NVIDIA's valuation today is in fact below its five-year average on a forward price to earnings ratio. It is in fact below where it was on a forward price to earnings ratio compared to May 2023. And there's a very good explanation for that. Over the next 12 months, NVIDIA is forecasted to increase its revenues at 250% per year, which is astronomical. Focus more on valuation rather than price. And the other thing is, it can help you when you're managing a portfolio, I think, to take less drastic action. You can sometimes only shed 10% or 25%. or maybe in extreme cases, 50%, but you have to set rules for yourself. Like, what is my sector diversification going to remain? What is my asset allocation going to be? Whenever you make these decisions to sell or to trim, you want to be operating within a set of guidelines that you have set for yourself. For example, maybe you never want a single security to be more than 10% of your total holdings. Well, maybe you can trim down to that level in smaller increments. You don't need to let go of 80% of it or all of it. So sometimes taking less drastic action can actually pay dividends down the road. From a big picture perspective, though, guys, I realize we are talking about money. We are talking about wealth. We are actually talking about the things that are less important in life compared to our health, compared to our loved ones, compared to the experiences that we are creating. When I look at my blessings, I think about all these things. And to a lesser degree than I think about the 20% of the NVIDIA shares that I kept, I try to focus more on the positives of becoming charitable and starting that aspect of my life and learning about as many things as I can along the way. Okay, investing pitfall number four that I have struggled with is investing into the markets when the markets are at all-time highs. Guys, this is a thing that I struggle with the most. This is a thing that I struggle with today as we speak. We just went through a two-year period where we had incredible market volatility, where we had many, many dips, where there were incredible opportunities to buy. Why do I love to buy on the dips? Well, when you buy at lower prices, you are increasing your future predicted returns. And it's also in my nature. It's also how I was raised. And when I go shopping in the real world, I like to look for sales. This is just part of my DNA. But I think the best way to overcome this tendency, at least for myself, is to become a student of history. And one of the books that helped me to better understand this is Balance by Andrew Hallam. He does a deep dive into what investment returns have been for 30-year periods. He argues that this is the only period that really matters, because we should all, as investors, have a long-term mindset. And one of the most compelling statistics that he shares in the book, and I'm citing this only for S&P 500 returns, but if you go back in time and you ask yourself, what was the very worst year to dump all your money into the markets? It would have been 1929, right before the massive market crash as the Great Depression was starting. Yet, Andrew Hallam says, if you invested every dime you had at that time, your 30-year annualized returns still would have exceeded 8%. Now let's compare that to somebody who timed the market perfectly, invested at 1932, 1933, every dime they had. Yes, it's true that their average annualized returns over 30 years would have been higher at a little more than 13%, but the argument here is that how can you go wrong with 8% annualized returns? Mind you, this does not account for inflation. This does not account for tax. But the point here is that if you have a long-term mindset, you should be fine if you're looking at 30-year returns. So I'm going to leave it at that. I'm going to leave it on a positive note. And remember, guys, like, nobody has to do what I'm doing here. Nobody has to go out and buy individual stocks. I think there's ample evidence out there that shows that ETFs are probably going to be the best course forward for the majority of people. And also remember that I mentioned a lot of individual companies in this episode. There are no buy or sell recommendations. It is education only. Please, 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 the biggest lessons that I can convey from this episode are, please do your own due diligence. Please understand what you're investing in. And I think that if you have the curiosity to learn about businesses, I think that it can be a lot of fun. But be careful while you're at it. And until next time, stay well, stay savvy.